Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 22nd of August. It's All Things Political, which you always hear Mondays at 9 here on the Ideas Network. We have as our guest this hour Professor George Waller. He is a senior lecturer in political science at the University of Wisconsin Fox Valley, teaches American government and politics, political science, comparative politics, international politics, media and politics, and we are going to be talking about a number of issues. We thought we might start with some state issues because when the legislature returns in a little while, it will be a different legislature with the Republicans not having as much of a majority. Will that change the way business is done? Are we entering a new spirit of collaboration is the question. Some of the bills likely up for vote, venture capital, a rewritten version of a bill to encourage venture capital in Wisconsin. You'll recall that there was a snafu over this earlier this year over the money that could be given to out-of-state financial management firms for investing in venture capital. Iron ore mining, sure to be controversial, a bill that would ease the way to construct a mine in Ashland and Iron Counties, also a top priority. Recall rules, a constitutional amendment to tighten restrictions on reasons for recalling state lawmakers. Pre-abortion ultrasounds, a bill that would require a woman to have an ultrasound before getting an abortion, and tighten regulations for clinics that perform abortions. There's also immigration on the table and teacher assessments, allowing student test scores to be a factor in whether teachers should be fired. We'll look at those issues, and of course, we will also look at what's going on nationally this hour. The president's approval ratings dipped below 40% for the first time last week. It's higher than the ratings for Congress, but still not where this president wants to be during a time which seems like it's fairly close, although it's still fairly far away to the 2012 elections. He's been talking about changing his plan for jobs. What do you think about the new possibilities, and where should he be on this jobs issue? He's talked about refurbishing dilapidated schools and also a tax credit to encourage businesses to add employees, an issue we've been talking about, jobs, that is, for a long, long time. We'll be welcoming phone calls, as we always do. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor George Waller, hello. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, nice to have you here. So is this a new spirit of cooperation in the state of Wisconsin?
Well, that remains to be seen. It's clear that there has been a lot of talk recently about moving to a more collaborative environment. I think you've heard both Governor Walker and clearly members of the Republican Senate and even some of the Democrats talking about trying to reach agreement on some of the things that would focus on, as you mentioned, venture capital, jobs creation, and the like. Again, we'll have to wait and see. There are also some proposals that are going to be advanced that obviously will create great division between Democrats and Republicans in this state, particularly the measure to be introduced by Michelle Lichens and Senator Mary Lasich on requiring the women seeking an abortion to undergo an ultrasound and the tightening of regulations for clinics that perform abortions. That will be obviously controversial if that should come up and could clearly create a situation where those animosities and divisions between Republicans and Democrats will be once again very visible. Again, I'll wait and see. I'm hesitant, you know, because we've gone through a situation in this state where there have been such deep divisions and such anger and animosity between the two parties that we'll wait and see whether or not this spirit of collaboration that's been talked about will actually come to fruition.
Tell me what your thoughts are about the new legislature. Do you see it as a body that will have to compromise more, or because the Republicans still have complete control, can they still pretty much set the agenda?
Well, I mean, their majority in the Senate clearly has been trimmed significantly as a result of the recall elections. Rather than their 1914 majority, which they had prior to those recalls, they now simply have a one-seat majority, 17-16, in the Senate. So perhaps in the Senate you may see an effort to reach across the aisle more so than you will see, obviously, in the Assembly, where Republicans still have a significant advantage. Clearly, if one Republican swings in favor of a Democratic position in the Senate, it could create an interesting situation. But Republicans still have the majority, and I think that's something they were very, very pleased to notice following those recall elections. Don't know at this point. We'll have to see what happens when the legislature convenes again in the fall.
As is the case nationally, and we'll talk about the president and jobs in a moment, the focus the Democrats would like to see, as Assembly Minority Leader Peter Barca has said, hearings to be set up on bipartisan economic development proposals, creating jobs being the number one priority in the state of Wisconsin. Can we all agree on that?
I do think that that will be, at least at the beginning, the main focus of the legislature and the governor. I mean, it's clearly something that both nationally and in this state is something that the public is demanding. I mean, with the state of the economy nationally and the state of the economy here in Wisconsin, it's clear that there has to be a much more committed focus, bipartisan committed focus on job creation.
You mentioned this pre-abortion ultrasounds. There hasn't been a whole lot of legislation looking at some of those very controversial social issues. Will there be more of those social issues, do you think, on the agenda or not?
Well, I think initially there will be an effort in the legislature not to advance those or to give those priority. I think the focus will be, as we mentioned earlier, jobs creation and giving Wisconsin's economy a boost. I think that will be the focus. But you know, there are committed members of the legislature who want to advance these social issues. And as I say, if those do make it onto the front burner of the legislature, it could once again force the legislature back into that very divisive and very partisan wrangle.
What was your assessment of the recall elections?
Well, you know, there's sort of something for both, I would guess. I mean, clearly, Republicans were extremely happy about their ability to stave off some of those recalls, particularly, I would say, in Senate District 8, where Alberta Darling faced Sandy Pasch. I think that was one that caused some concern for Republicans and clearly was one the Democrats were hoping that they would be able to win. That, obviously, going to Alberta Darling, 54-46% is something that clearly meant that the Senate would stay in Republican hands. And so clearly that is a victory for Republicans in the state of Wisconsin and for Scott Walker, and it a deep disappointment for Democrats who were really hoping that they would be able to capture the Senate. Yet at the same time, there were obviously with Jessica King's win over Randy Hopper and with the defeat of Kapanke in the district near La Crosse, where Jennifer Schilling won, those were clearly victories for Democrats that that give some indication, at least to Republicans, and particularly Scott Walker, that statewide races are going to be extremely competitive. You have that District 32 now trending more towards the Democrats. You have the District 8, the district, well, I'm forgetting which district it is, District 18, where Jessica King defeated Randy Hopper, another one very, very close. And even the Senate District 14 with Luther Olson and Fred Clark, one that really came down to the wire with just a relatively small margin of victory for Luther Olson, means that we've seen what we all knew going into these recalls, that this state is very, very divided, almost a 50-50 state. So something for all. Clearly, Republicans feeling victorious as a result of being able to hold the Senate.
And where do you see the possible recall of Scott Walker? Do you think that this is going to happen, or has the oomph gone out of the whole movement?
Oh, I think there will be an effort. It's difficult to recall a sitting governor. I think it requires nearly 500,000 signatures to initiate a recall effort, and that will obviously be a challenge for those who wish to seek that effort to recall Scott Walker. And, of course, we'll have to wait and see what happens with the attempt by Robin Voss to introduce his measure, which would change the way recall elections are done here in the state of Wisconsin. Don't know. We'll see. But I would suspect that there will be an effort underway to initiate a recall against Scott Walker. Mm-hmm.
And do you think there's merit in that effort to tighten restrictions on the reasons why we recall state lawmakers?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, this is an unusual political season here in the state of Wisconsin. It hasn't been a matter of course here in the state of Wisconsin that we've had these kinds of recall efforts. Clearly an indication of the degree to which the state is deeply, deeply divided on many of these issues and deeply divided between the two major parties. I don't know whether there's merit in it. It seems to me that we've had these recall measures in our Constitution in the past, and they haven't been problematic. I suspect there will be an effort by some in the Republican Party, and clearly Representative Voss, to try and change that constitutional language with respect to recalls. My sense is that I don't think it will go very far. Surely it will not be something supported by the Democrats, and changing the Constitution here in the state is not the easiest thing to do legislatively.
Let's talk about jobs in the country before we start taking phone calls. And the president's approval rating, which is below 40% for the first time, he seems to be struggling to put together some kind of proposal that will deal with jobs. He's talking about billions of dollars to refurbish dilapidated schools, tax credits for businesses to add employees. Do you expect some major jobs proposal from him? Why is he not giving one?
Well, it's interesting that the president has decided to wait until after Labor Day to deliver his speech on his new strategy or his new plan for jobs creation. I think he's clearly doing that in an effort to sort of focus public attention, which typically doesn't tend to focus much politically until after Labor Day anyway, on the divisions between the president and the Republican-controlled Congress. We don't have any specifics at this point. I think it's clear that we know that the president in the past has talked about the kinds of federally spurred stimulus job creation programs, and my suspicion is that with respect to the refurbishment of dilapidated schools, it will be that kind of an approach again. I'm not sure whether that will be well received by Republicans in the Congress. I don't think Republicans in the Congress are particularly predisposed to be supportive of much of anything the president will put together or put forward by way of a jobs creation program. I'm not terribly optimistic that we'll see much substantively by way of a bipartisan agreement on jobs creation measures that the president may put forward.
We welcome phone calls, and we'll take them in a moment. You're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. George Waller is our guest. He is senior lecturer at the University of Wisconsin Fox Valley in political science. And our number, one line is open, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, feel free to use that if you'd like, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our show, Alfred Hitchcock. You may have read about three reels of his early feature film, which had thought to have been lost, have turned up in New Zealand, of all places, in time for what would have been the director's 112th birthday. We'll be speaking with the author of Hitchcock at Work and Masters of Cinema, Alfred Hitchcock, our number two of our show. To your phone calls for Professor George Waller as we talk about all things political this hour, and we start with Joe in Milwaukee. Hi, Joe.
Hi. You know, I want to revisit this spirit of collaboration thing that's supposed to be taking place up there in Madison. You know, it seems to me like it's like somebody stole my dog, and now they want my help building the doghouse. What do you think of the validity of that attempt on Walker's part?
Well, again, I think, you know, there is an effort, or at least lip service being paid, and we'll see whether that lip service will be translated into a real effort to reach across the aisle and forge a kind of spirit of collaboration. But I think there is at least some hope. I think that there will be an effort to put the real divisiveness of the political landscape in Wisconsin behind so that we can focus more directly on the kinds of things that I think voters in the state of Wisconsin really are focused on, and that is job creation and helping the state of Wisconsin's economy. You know, that's not only here in the state of Wisconsin, it's nationally, and I think it does present a challenge both nationally and in the various states to get beyond this kind of political divisiveness and begin to work together to do the kinds of things that will spur the economy and create jobs. Again, I'm not terribly optimistic that once we get into the hurly-burly of a legislative session that will continue, but I think it is at least a welcome sign for many that at least there is this attempt to at least talk about forging a new spirit of collaboration. Remains to be seen whether that will be, in effect, will be realized once the legislature begins to meet this fall.
Joe, do you think there's any issue on which there can be collaboration?
You know, I think this schools thing is, they've got to come together on that. The rest of Walker's agenda, I don't think that the Democrats should play along. I don't even think they should give him the time of day on it. Schools are most important, I think.
Thanks, Joe.
Yeah, and of course, education is one of those things that I think there is generally bipartisan agreement that something needs to be done to strengthen the state of public education here in the state of Wisconsin. Of course, there are different proposals and obviously different positions between Republicans and Democrats on just how we go about doing that. But perhaps that may be one of the area in which we might see some attempt at reaching some kind of bipartisan agreement.
Except some of those proposals are radically different, aren't
they? Indeed, they are.
Yes.
That's why, you know, it's one thing to talk about collaboration in the abstract. It's a very different thing when you get into the details of legislation and public policy where there are these deep divisions in terms of philosophy and approach to think whether or not that can be put in the background and you can work together to achieve some sort of bipartisan compromise. I don't know whether that will happen. We'll wait and see.
Joe, thanks very much for your call. Willem in Colfax, hi.
Hi. I don't know if a lot of people are aware of this, but the Western Wisconsin...
Can you speak up a little? We can't hear you very well. There you go.
People in this western part of Wisconsin were noticing that there's a huge and rapid expansion of this frac sand mining, and it's, you know, there's not... they don't have to pay the people of Western Wisconsin very much money in any form of tax or anything like that, and I'm worried that... our, you know, rural economy and landscape is going to change into a mining economy with all the, you know, bad side effects of noise and huge truck traffic and light pollution, and it's really going to change the environment in this part of the state, and I'm worried that our current leadership thinks this is a great idea, and there's very little benefit to the residents here. And there's a great loss, I think, also of viable farmland, which could be used for growing biofuels or ever-increasing demands on food production with growing populations around the world, plus the threat to our common water aquifer. I mean, the downside, I think, is way more than the upside, and very few people benefit, and very many people lose the quality of life, I think.
Thanks, Willem. George.
Well, there you go. Those are the kinds of arguments, and those are the kinds of notions that are clearly going to be put forward when the mining legislation comes up on the floor of the Wisconsin State Legislature. There is this sort of idea that that might be an area where there would be some sort of collaboration because of the emphasis or the focus on jobs creation here in the state. But clearly, those kinds of mining issues do, in fact, bring up and raise a number of the issues that the caller talked about with respect to environmental degradation and the like. And I suspect that there will certainly be those concerns raised in the state legislature when that mining legislation comes forward. Whether or not that kind of concern will carry the day in this kind of an economy where job creation is the focus, I think remains to be seen.
And thanks for your call. Frank in Wisconsin Dells. Hi.
How you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My idea is about job creation, and the idea is kind of, it's an old idea, just a different project, kind of like the CCC back in the 30s and 40s when that project create jobs instantly. Hire people to all along the rail. Okay, first of all, my idea is called Health Highway, and what it is two covers two things with one stone, basically. Gets people healthy, and it puts people to work. All along our railroad tracks is plenty of room to put a bicycle path, hiking path. All the railroad beds, 5% grade at the most, so they're real comfortable for riding and hiking and whatnot. It would connect the whole country so people could commute on bicycle if they wanted to, not the way it is now. It's so dangerous to ride your bike from, one state to the other, or even around your state, to get around. The railroads are everywhere, pretty much in everybody's backyard. Not only putting just the regular workers, regular people to work, people that own companies with, tractors and gravel and whatnot, gravel would be needed, materials would be needed. It would be just instantly get this country going and get the economy going. It would get people working. Everybody's talking about this and that. Let's do something that actually is going to work.
George.
It worked before. It'll work again.
Yeah.
What
do you think, George?
Yeah, well, this is clearly something that the president and many of the Democrats, at least on the national level, have been arguing for, which would obviously mean that the federal government would be involved in stimulating job creation through federal spending. That's clearly something that Republicans in the Congress have said they will not agree to, allow more federal spending on those kinds of shovel-ready, stimulus kinds of job creation programs. Instead, their focus has been on private business and private industry securing the kind of tax breaks and the like that will stimulate jobs creation. And I think that's the real point of division between Democrats and Republicans. Clearly, I think the president has in the past been an advocate of just exactly the kinds of jobs creation programs that the caller mentions. This is, again, that point of deep division between Republicans and Democrats nationally, and I think even here in the state of Wisconsin.
Let's talk a little bit more about the president's style of governing, because I always have questions about this, and so you can answer this for me. The Democrats really are still in charge. They've got the Senate. They don't have the House, but they have the presidency. Are we looking at a matter of the president not forcefully outlining what he thinks should happen and really pounding on it over and over and over? Or are we looking at the administration not being able to maneuver through Congress? What's the problem here?
Well, I think that certainly is part of it, and certainly that's one of the criticisms that has been leveled at Barack Obama, particularly from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, that he's too ready to capitulate, he's too ready to seek compromise, and isn't forceful enough in pushing forward his proposals and actually strong-arming politically the Congress of the United States to get things achieved. At the same time, however, it's clear that although Democrats have control of the Senate, because of the necessity so often on many of these measures to secure 60 votes, with a deeply partisan division in the Senate of the United States, that functionally means that the president is not able to sort of cajole or corral the Senate behind his proposals, even though it is marginally controlled by the Democrats. And in the House, of course, it's another story altogether. Clearly, the structure and the organization of the House has always been such that an organized and cohesive and united majority will always get its way. And if there's one thing we have seen in recent times, both when the Democrats were in control with Nancy Pelosi, and even more so today with John Boehner and the Republicans in the House, they are absolutely united in their opposition to the kinds of things that are put forward by Barack Obama. So we have, again, this very, very sharp partisan division that prevents the kind of working together and compromise that really is what our system requires for things to go forward. Criticisms on all sides. I think clearly Barack Obama is partly to blame, and I think that's part of the reason you see his approval numbers so low. It's not just Republicans; it's many Democrats, and particularly progressive liberal Democrats, who are disheartened and unhappy with the performance of the president.
Thanks, Frank. Jim in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. The bottom line is you vote progressive or you get regressive. What we have here is a war without the bullets, and Obama's lovey-dovey doesn't work. In today's Chicago Sun-Times, on the You Think editorial page, there's an article called Is Perry's Texas Miracle What America Really Needs? And it talks about all sorts of deficiencies in the economic climate in Texas, including things about home ownership, their lax regulatory system. It points out that Texas has the highest rate of workers paid at or below the federal minimum wage. Median hourly wage is 10% lower than the national average. Dead last in the percentage of individuals with health insurance, near the bottom in the percentage of employer workers with employee-based health insurance. 9 Texans a week die in accidents. They're at the top in the number of people without workers' comp coverage, and just generally a very deficient economy below the surface projections that Perry puts out about his bluster about things going well. And people have to work harder, and they have to vote progressive, or we're not going to get anything done.
Well, I think what the caller is talking about here are all the kinds of things that clearly will come to the fore as Governor Perry becomes more and more a candidate of a focus by the media. Texas's economy, by comparison to the other states, is doing relatively well, and there are a host of reasons for that. Despite the kinds of legitimate criticisms that the caller brings forward about the state of the economy in Texas, nonetheless, if you look at it in terms of its performance as a state, it's done fairly well, and it's not necessarily entirely because of the policies of Rick Perry. In many ways, Texas has been a beneficiary of federal programs that have allowed its economy to sort of flourish in this terrible economic circumstance. It's also true, as the caller points out, that there are many, many deficiencies in Texas. 26% of Texas's population is not covered by health insurance. It leads the nation in terms of the percentage of uncovered people in its state. And so there are many, many things that I think will be brought forward as Rick Perry, who's a relatively recent entrant into the GOP nomination fray, will clearly be the subject of focus of the media, and clearly things that Rick Perry will have to answer to.
Who appears to be, in your mind, most likely to succeed in the Republican presidential field?
Boy, it's so early. My guess at this point is that Mitt Romney is still probably one of those who's in the lead. I think Rick Perry at this point is, and it may be more a result of the fact that he's one of the most recent entrants. It's very difficult to determine. I mean, the Luntz poll just the other day, which is a Republican polling organization with a really good track record of sort of keeping its finger on the pulse of Republican voters around the country, clearly indicates that at this point only 12% of Republican voters have are satisfied with the candidates seeking the nomination and have also decided who they're going to vote for, with about 44% of them saying they're completely dissatisfied with the candidates, and another 44% saying they're satisfied but haven't yet decided who they're going to vote for. A long time before we see who actually is going to emerge from this early, early process.
Thanks, Jim, for your call. Let's go to Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Governor Walker has said, both as in the past as governor and in this previous office as Milwaukee County executive, that essentially a lot of the things that we've taken as almost for granted as, you know, in the 21st century, he essentially believes that it's not the government's job. Like, for if he had his way, there would be no public schools. It would simply be vouchers issued to people who could then use them to go to private schools. In other words, everything he's done has been essentially to gut the public school system. As far as jobs, the idea is that the job creators, as he calls them, should be allowed to do pretty much whatever they want. Not have to pay taxes, not have to, you know, and not have to provide a decent wage, a decent living wage, etc. And that way they can hire lots and lots of people who work at crushing poverty wages, kind of like Mississippi or Texas or Louisiana. Those are his ideals for the kind of job creation programs he wants. Now, I don't see that any civilized person would want that, and there's just no middle ground. As on the national level, it's even worse. You have Obama, who's trying to maintain something that you have an extreme division on the from the right and the left. It seems like our whole electoral system is set up now to select for extreme right, extreme left, and if you're someone who's sort of in the middle, you just kind of have to hold your nose and pick one. And I just don't see that there's any room for compromise or bipartisanship or anything. It's just, I'm not very pessimistic. I just wanted to hear his comments.
All right, Bill, thanks.
Well, I think, you know, it's clear that there is an ideological and philosophical difference between Scott Walker and many of the Republicans nationally, John Kasich in Ohio, Mitch Daniels in Indiana, and the Republicans on the national level, in terms of the role and the size and scope of the federal government. And here in the state of Wisconsin and other states, the size and scope of the role of state government. I think the caller is correct in sort of characterizing the philosophy of Scott Walker and many who think less as he does in the Republican Party, that the role of state and federal government needs to be significantly downsized. And that obviously puts them at real odds with many Democrats and progressives who feel, particularly at this time, the role of state and federal government ought to be focused more on creating the kinds of jobs, creating the kinds of situations that will advance the economy and advance the lives of people both nationally and in the states. We have a real ideological and philosophical chasm between the two parties. However, it appears to me that one of the things that many voters are yearning for, and perhaps the caller sort of spoke to this, is the notion that there has got to be some way to forge a middle ground. Perhaps this new debt committee, this super committee, will be a committee that will be forced to deal with finding that middle ground in dealing at least with the national level conversation.
It seems to me, George, that there seems to be a lack of urgency about this whole issue, and it affects so many people who have lost their jobs, who don't have incomes, who seeing unemployment compensation run out, who are underemployed. It's such a large problem in the country. What's everybody supposed to do? Sit around and wait until somebody decides to come up with something that might work? Where's the urgency about this?
Well, you know, clearly the urgency is felt by the voters and felt by the people.
Right, right.
And I think what's getting in the way of it is this real philosophical partisan division between Republicans and Democrats. Republicans want to focus on spending levels, that, you know, spending is the issue, that deficits are out of control, that the size and scope of federal spending and state spending has resulted in these crippling kind of deficits, which from their point of view are obviously part of the problem in spurring an economy and in growing jobs. From the point of view of the Democrats, the idea here is, well, deficits are something we need to definitely consider, but we also need to think about how we increase revenues both at the state and federal level in order to provide for the kinds of stimulus programs that have been shown to create jobs. How you create jobs when you are at the same time cutting spending significantly at both the federal and the national level is really, really the issue here. Republicans, as a previous caller pointed out, are focused on the private sector and job creation and freeing the private sector from the regulations and controls imposed on the private sector by government. A philosophical sort of ideological debate that's getting in the way of an attempt to really sit down and force some sort of urgent a compromise in dealing with these things. That's why I say perhaps this super debt committee that has to come up with recommendations by November 23rd, or there will be automatic spending cuts across the board, will be that group that will be forced to, you know, to put its nose to the grindstone and do that kind of difficult work.
George Waller, our guest for All Things Political. He's a senior lecturer, political science at the University of Wisconsin, Fox Valley. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two, we'll talk about Alfred Hitchcock. Three reels of his earliest film were discovered recently in New Zealand, just in time for his 112th birthday celebration last week. We're going to be talking with a gentleman who's written books about Alfred Hitchcock and the master of suspense. That's hour number two of the show. 800-486-8655 is our number, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. We go next to George in Arborvitae. Hi, George.
Hi. I want to talk about the dilapidated schools.
All right.
One must ask, how did the school become dilapidated? It must be a loss of responsibility of either a local government, a county government, and probably not even a state government, but certainly not the federal government. There is absolutely nothing in the Constitution that establishes the right of the federal government to build schools. Why don't the people in Wisconsin look inwardly and correct their own shortcomings instead of looking to the federal government? This country for 200 years has been built on the backs of hardworking people pursuing their own dreams, not what the federal government has done. The federal government has contributed next to nothing on the prosperity of this country. I'll take my answer offline.
All right, George. Professor Waller.
Well, I would say this. The caller is right in terms of the percentage of the support that is given to public education. It primarily falls on the backs of local county and state entities, and the role of the federal government in education has been historically much, much smaller. I think what clearly is seen here is that the condition of many of these so-called dilapidated schools have become such as a result of an inability, if you will, or maybe even an unwillingness on the part of local, county, and state taxpayers to provide the kind of financial input that would arrest those kinds of dilapidated conditions, that would fix those kinds of conditions. I think clearly what you're seeing now, if in fact Barack Obama puts forward some measure from the federal government to deal with dilapidated schools, is an effort by the federal government to help out already hard-pressed local, county, and state taxpayers and governments to deal with those conditions of dilapidated schools that clearly have an impact on the quality of education received by public school children throughout the country. So I think, while the caller is correct that historically the federal role in education has not been as expansive as either the state or the local role, it's clear that when you're in this kind of a situation where revenues and finances are stretched at those local and state levels, they may need assistance from the federal government in order to deal with the conditions of dilapidated schools throughout the country. And I think that's where this focus or this program will be headed.
Email from Lee in Milwaukee. I'm worn out by the constant electioneering campaigning. What are the pros and cons to having the House on a four-year cycle instead of its present two-year cycle?
Wow. Well, I mean, for one thing, I mean, that would require, I believe, a constitutional amendment to change that, because the Constitution says that members of the House of Representatives are elected on two-year terms. And that would be, of course, problematic because it would require a two-thirds vote in both the House and Senate to put forward as a proposal and then get three-quarters of the states to ratify it, which is a very cumbersome process in terms of changing the Constitution. There's always been some sort arguments on behalf of extending the terms of members of Congress, or even for that matter, the term of the President of the United States. But I do not think, given the kind of political landscape here in the United States and the traditions in the United States, that voters are going to essentially give up their ability to hold their members of the House of Representatives accountable for their actions on a two-year basis. I don't see it as something that's likely. You could make an argument that it would create a little bit more stability in that there wouldn't be the constant kind of electioneering that we see, particularly in the House of Representatives. But, I mean, even in Senate races and even in four-year presidential terms, politics in this country has been such that it's always focused on electioneering. It's always about the next election. So, again, I don't know how we'll get around that.
Chris in Appleton, hi.
Hi, it's such a great show. It just gets my brain reeling and awake for the morning.
Good.
The 100 comments, but now I'll stick to the one I started with. What is the Republican officials, are they representatives, what is their response to Warren Buffett's comments late last week?
I haven't heard much from Republicans with respect to that. You certainly heard a whole lot from progressive Democrats, who, of course, think that what Warren Buffett had to say was just exactly the kind of thing they'd like to hear. It's very interesting. One of the things that came across my screen this morning was there seems to be some reticence on the part of Republicans in the Congress of the United States to extend the payroll tax credit that Barack Obama was able to initiate a couple of years ago, which would effectively mean, if it isn't extended, that taxes for middle-class taxpayers across the country will go up rather significantly, at least payroll taxes. There's this real reluctance on the part of many in the Republican Party to want to raise taxes on who they see as the so-called jobs creators, the wealthy, the corporations from their point of view represent private sector job creation.
So this is a case in point, getting back to what confused me earlier. You've got the American public agreeing by well over 50% that those who make a great deal in this country should be taxed at higher levels. You've got a historical precedent for just that. You've got Warren Buffett saying, hey, they're taxing me at 17.6%. That's ridiculous. My secretary is getting taxed at a higher rate than I am. Why can't this be changed? You know, it's a minority opinion that's holding on to this belief that those rates should not be touched, that jobs will be generated. Why are they winning?
Well, you know, here's what I think's happening. I think you're absolutely correct that most Americans, whether they're Republican or Democrat, feel that there ought to be something by way of increasing taxes on those who are extremely wealthy. But at the same time, there is also a great deal of support, again, from Republicans and Democrats, from average Americans, that something really needs to be done about reining in the scope of government spending. And I think what people are seeing is they say, you know, we need to have some compromise here where we perhaps raise the rates on the most wealthy in this country. We preserve those tax credits for middle class taxpayers in terms of payroll tax, and we also get serious about doing something to rein in out of control government spending. So you've got, I think, a public that wants some middle ground sort of proposal or compromise, and yet we have two parties, it seems to me, who are diametrically opposed to one another on these issues and refuse to compromise. If anything, Barack Obama seems to be the one individual who has at least been talking about, and it seems to me in many of his proposals, trying to force some kind of compromise. But again, because of the nature of our divided government, he has been unable to see those things come to fruition. It's an unsettled public, a public that I think is very unhappy with both parties, unhappy with the federal government, unhappy with just the situation, of their lives.
And yes, I agree. Chris, thank you. Mark in Richland Center, hi.
Good morning. I think the biggest problem, as pointed out by Stephen Zarlenga of the American Monetary Institute, is that neither party really knows what the definition of money is. Money comes into existence after the people have done the work, and then they need this tool called money in the right amount within their economy, which is really just their work, in order to satisfy the trade that they need to do with each other. So it's literally called the money supply, and yet because our money supply is borrowed into existence instead of just as an act of government regulating the amount of currency in circulation, we don't ever have the right amount of money to do all the things that people want to do. You could create jobs like crazy if you would separate the issue of money from the banking industry and let that just be a function of federal government to have the right amount of currency in existence. But we haven't done that this time anyway since the Federal Reserve came into existence. But the entire monetary history of this country has struggled with this because Jackson fought against private issue of money. Lincoln fought against it. The very Revolutionary War was to get free from a private issue money system out of England. So it's time that we really got to a true definition of what is money and then put it into the hands of a regulatory entity, which is basically ourselves, so that we have the tool necessary for us to do our work. There's no reason why we have to have money first. The work actually comes first and then calls money into existence.
All right. Do you want to comment, George?
Well, I'll tell you this. There's a discussion that will clearly shake the heads of many in the American public. But I think the caller has a good point, and I think, we'll see whether that kind of a substantive debate on that kind of a basic economic notion will actually emerge from all of this.
Let's go to an email. Jim in Boulder Junction. The governor has rammed through voter suppression and egregious redistricting in an attempt to make Wisconsin Republican for the next 50 years. He sent the unions packing, cut education while paying off his business cronies with sweetheart deals. Now he's completed his agenda and wants to play nice with the Democrats. Believe that, and I've got a bridge for sale.
Well, I wonder what perspective that voter actually has. I mean, clearly, it's true. The reforms that have been done in terms of voter registration and the requirement of IDs for voters is clearly something that I think, at least in some respects, was done in order to hold down voting by some traditional Democratic constituencies. I think clearly the redistricting effort that was brought forward by the legislature was one that was done at least in large measure to preserve and protect Republican support and strength in the state. That's clearly something that is facing a constitutional lawsuit or a lawsuit over whether it was constitutional to do so, because as the lawsuit contends, they did so in a way that was unconstitutional by ignoring or not actually receiving first the plans from local and county municipal districts across the state. So, you know, we'll see how that all eventually plays out. And, of course, you know, all of this will be the subject of what I suspect will be an effort to recall Governor Walker, and clearly will remain on the agenda as deep political issues when Governor Walker, in the event that he is not recalled, runs for re-election a couple of short years from now.
We have about a minute left. Charlie in Winona, Minnesota. Hi.
Hi. All I ever hear is smoke screens coming from the politicians. And during all those smoke screens, the Americans lose their jobs, they lose their manufacturing, and then the rich politicians who've got all these, the people they have to pay back that put them into office, they're rich. So they're not going to vote on a tax decrease for themselves. I'm self-employed. I pay 37% taxes every year, and that's not fair. I'm the manufacturer and seller of kick-ass beef jerky in Wisconsin and Minnesota. I like to see a kick-ass government.
All right. Thanks, Charlie, very much for your call. George, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
I always enjoy it, Kathleen.
Yeah, I do too. Professor George Waller, our guest for All Things Political, senior lecturer in political science, teaches American government, politics, political science, comparative politics, international politics. We first met him, how many years ago was that, when we went around the state doing broadcast? No, we didn't. No, that was a special broadcast we did in Appleton. Not that long ago. 4 years ago, maybe? 4 years ago. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios, where it is a picture-perfect day. What a day. Whew. Thanks for all of your calls. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio, and we'll return. I always get scared when I talk about Alfred Hitchcock. We'll talk about the master of suspense. So stay with us.